Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Levels of carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the atmosphere hit a new record of 410.5 parts per million in 2019, the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, has said. In its annual greenhouse gas bulletin, the UN agency announced that concentrations of CO2 are expected to keep rising this year. This is despite a slight reduction in emissions owing to the COVID-19 pandemic. Carbon dioxide is the most important of several greenhouse gases that trap heat in the atmosphere and contribute to climate change. Its levels have risen by 48% since pre-industrial times, WMO said in a press conference. Here's Oksana Tarasova, WMO Chief of Atmospheric and Environment Research Division, speaking to a news conference in Geneva.
So the CO2 which we have now in the atmosphere is accumulated since 1750. So it's every single bit which we put in the atmosphere since that time actually forms the current concentration. It's not what happened today or yesterday. It's the whole history of the human economic and human development which actually lead us to this global level of 410 PM.
WMO Secretary General Petteri Tallas said that COVID-19 related lockdowns were expected to reduce this year's carbon dioxide emissions by between 4% and 7%. This was despite the fact that pandemic lockdowns limited people's mobility but not their consumption of energy, the UN agency explained. To Yemen now, and a dire warning from UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, that youngsters are at greater risk than ever as the country slowly inches towards famine. In her message, UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said that despite the agency's best efforts, it cannot hold back the tide indefinitely. More than 12 million children need humanitarian assistance in Yemen, which has been locked in a widening civil conflict since 2015. In addition, nearly 325,000 children under the age of 5 suffer from severe acute malnutrition and are fighting to survive, Ms. Fore said, adding that more than 5 million face a heightened threat of cholera and acute watery diarrhea. The UNICEF chief urged all parties to the conflict to keep children out of harm's way and allow unhindered access to communities in need, as is their duty under international humanitarian law. Ms. Fore also called on donors to step up with urgently needed additional funds, highlighting a gap of almost $300 million. Humanitarian aid alone will not avert a famine nor end the crisis, she said, before calling for the war to end and support for the economy to help Yemenis rebuild their country. A high-level pledging for development conference in Afghanistan got underway in Geneva on Monday, where UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has appealed to all parties to the conflict to do more to save lives and commit to peace with a ceasefire. In her message to some 70 countries taking part, Ms. Bachelet said that more than 2,000 civilians have been killed so far this year and nearly 4,000 injured. She also urged the government and Taliban representatives taking part in the peace negotiations in Doha to make immediate commitments to safeguard civilian life. This move could save thousands of families from suffering, lessen recriminations, and bolster confidence and trust among negotiators, the High Commissioner said. She called on all armed actors to end attacks on and around hospitals and schools and to stop using them as military bases. In his message to delegates, UN Refugee Chief Filippo Grandi also urged the international community to remain committed to the country. He also called for greater support for Afghan refugees, internally displaced and returnees at the end of his 5-day visit to Kabul and the provinces of Bamiyan and Parwan. The upward trend of violence, which included killing, maiming, terrorizing and displacing Afghan civilians every day, must be stopped immediately, Mr. Grandi said, noting that it was the main driver of displacement. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is Radio Free Kansas. You never know on Tuesday. I'm telling you, we've got this can't be happening. And John Grant has filed a new story at this can't be happening. And it's a weird, John, this is a weird story, brother. I mean, I've been reading it. I read it last night. Uh-huh. And you put it up, and now I'm reading it again.
It's getting weirder.
Don't tell me. Job Squeaky. squeaky Joe Biden, who barely won, is going to give the shaft to his most ardent supporters who helped him, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And that's sort of the drift of what I got out of this.
Well, it was, it's a theme that I've developed when I've been encouraging people to hold their nose and vote for Joe Biden instead of the Green Party candidate. You know, I've done that for,
yeah,
God, almost a year, I guess, or what, maybe less. But, you know, Joe Biden right off the bat has this quote I read in the Times. It's like, we're having trouble, you know, Trump won't even concede that he's lost, but yet now is the time that we need to cross the aisle and deal with Republicans. I'm going like, whoa, let's slow down,
yeah,
just a little bit, you know? I mean, sure, there's Mitt Romney and McCusky and the woman from Maine, all these people. But you know, you don't need to cross the aisle and go to them. Let them come to you. You know, I mean, as I say, you know, after all the slander and the terrible things they've been doing, trying to undermine your win and all this stuff and slander you and whatnot, they deserve a period in the desert, if you will, you know. I mean, we on the left have been in the desert for decades, you know. Let's let them go out in the desert for a little bit. Anyway, that's kind of the theme. It's a little tongue-in-cheek.
Well, it's
a
great article. It's a really good article. I mean, don't get me wrong. It pisses me off because I'm smelling, actually, Obama, I don't know how much Obama won that election, his first election for president, but I remember that distinctly.
Mm-hmm.
Having friends on the left, I'm talking about socialist, anti-war,
right,
left, not the Democratic Party, okay?
Right.
I had friends back then pushing me, you know, something about the book Obama wrote right before the
right
campaign for his election, about his father, I think. I can't remember.
It's an excellent book.
He's
a great writer, yeah.
Yeah, I read parts of it, big parts.
Yeah,
big
I have
parts
too,
of it.
Yeah.
It was recommended to me heartily by a socialist anti-war person in
mm-hmm.
Kansas, a friend of mine. And she was saying, you'll feel a lot better, you know, about voting for him, because it's
right.
So I read it and I thought, okay, well, I was going to vote for him anyhow.
Yeah, of course.
No way I want to. You know, I come from Brownbackistan. I come from Kansas. I know how wickedly
absolutely
bad Charles, the plutocrats run this place. You know, they've owned it since the Civil War.
You've got
know?
It. Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
So I fucking, but it was eye opening. I thought, well, maybe he's going to be okay, you know. And,
right.
You know,
of course.
And, he seemed to be pro-union. He says, if you want us to be more
mm-hmm.
pro-union, then make me be more pro. I thought, well, that's an FDR thing. Cool, yeah, let's make him.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing he did is he backed out of the card check. One of the first things Obama did. And then as it just gone on and on, the war, the drone, it shifted from troop invasions
right.
and surges, although he had a surge, it went
right.
to drone
right.
warfare.
Right.
And I keep thinking back to that period, and I'm thinking when I was reading
right.
your article at thiscan'tbehappening.net, listeners, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and I was thinking, oh God, another goddamn disappointment. You know, I mean, it's just like
I'm not looking at it that way. Yeah, but go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, well, then you bring up some of the weirdest periods in American history. Of the presidency, the odoriferous post-election maneuvering of 1876 that gave Rutherford B. Hayes the White House.
Right.
I was like, what? I even pursued that link. I was just reading it.
Well, I'm a little sketchy on it, but I read a wonderful little account in the Times, and there's I did link to a more substantial account of that period. But this is following Ulysses S. Grant's, I guess, his second term. And, you know, there's all sorts of ugly politics going on, certainly over the South and Reconstruction, you know, because, you know, Grant was good on Reconstruction, but then he lost it. And, you know, the KKK and all that rose up in the South and, you know, really, no pun intended, trumped the efforts by Ulysses S. Grant and other people to really have a, quote, Reconstruction in the South after Civil War. Well, then, you know, all of that, I don't know all the full details, all of that's going on. So there's, as my point is, this is not the first ugly election or post-election where the right and the left were at it. 1876 was a perfect example of that. Over the, you know, the aftermath of the Civil War and all those issues, which still linger in American politics and history. And there was this big stink, and there were several states that were, according to the Times account, the evidence is that they were truly disputable. In other words, not like, the point is, not like Michigan and Georgia and Arizona now, which are essentially not disputable. Michigan, where they were trying to overthrow the election, he even invited, as I pointed, state legislators, Republican state legislators, and public officials in the election to the White House. You know, with the only implication is he was working with them to see if it was possible for them to overrule the election, saying it was, you know, corrupt. And as is absolutely constitutionally legal, the state legislature can say, well, the election smells, and we're going to create our own, in this case, pro-Trump electoral delegates to go to the Electoral College. You know, fuck the election, which, what, campaign went on for at least 2 years? You know, well, screw that, you know. Well, in the case of 1876, there were disputed very, very close elections. Well, Biden won in Michigan by 154,000 votes, you know. It's like, holy shit. I mean, that's a lot of votes. You can't overturn that. I mean, the only overturning that they've ever done in an election by a recount was by a matter of something like 400 votes, you know, obtaining the difference. So my point is that, as the Times story, that this, looking back at this election, is a very interesting thing to do, because this is not the first time in American history where it really smelled, you know, and this one, as they point out, smells much, much more than 1876. And then, of course, at the end, I bring up the wonderful thing that I've written about before, wonderful in quotes, the 1933 coup attempt. It's kind of almost like sort of inept. Think of Trump as inept, you know.
Right.
Wall Street people, after the, quote, traitor to his class, Franklin Roosevelt, won the presidency from the one-term Herbert Hoover, right? As this guy was a traitor to his class. And so Wall Street, you know, by inauguration into the 1933, already Wall Street plutocrats were financing this broker guy, and he and a couple others went to Europe and studied all the black shirts, the brown shirts, and in Britain the silver shirts, and all those disgruntled World War II veterans that were, you know, in the case of Germany, and, you know, Kristallnacht and tearing up Jewish houses and whatnot, that these fascist shirt movements, they research that and say, well, how do we institute that in the United States against this socialist traitor to his class who has just taken over the presidency? Well, the U.S. military at the time, I don't even go into this detail, the U.S. military at the time was, you know, maybe 130,000 troops, and they were very sloppy and all this. Well, the American Legion had 500,000 members, And there were a lot of disgruntled World War II veterans, World War I veterans. World War I was not a popular war. It was like Vietnam almost at the end. And so there's a lot of disgruntled vets, you know, the bonus march and all that kind of stuff. And so they figured, well, geez, you know, the shirt movements utilizing disgruntled World War I vets in Europe, why don't we see, look at the American Legion, 500,000 and some of them disgruntled vets. Why don't we get, quote, a man on a white horse, you know, which is the necessary figure for a fascist movement, to mobilize this 500,000 member gang and it eventually, you know, figure out some way to move FDR aside. They were going to do what had been verboten up until then. They were going to publicize the fact that the president was a cripple in a wheelchair, et cetera, and he was a weakling, and we needed strength at this time. And, you know, they were going to create a cabinet. And it was a long, 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 but, it, you know, it was kind of half-baked, you know, kind of inept, like things that Trump would do. But it was backed by a lot of Wall Street money. And so they came to Smedley Butler, a Quaker Marine outside of Philadelphia, two Congressional Medals of Honor in his career since 1898 in the Spanish-American War. And but the troops loved him. That's why they wanted him, you know. And he went along with them. He played them along, and eventually he took the evidence that these people were actually seriously considering this coup or whatever you would call it against the new president, and he took it to the House Un-American Activities Committee, the famous HUAC committee that eventually was used by McCarthy and whatnot to attack communists. But one of the first things it did is it, thanks to Smedley Butler, discombobulated and ended any question about this coup that was sought by the far right to, you know, kind of get undemocratically move FDR out of the way. Well, right. Thanks to Smedley Butler, the House on it was revealed, and of course you never hear about it in history. And I think one of the reasons you don't hear about it is Franklin Roosevelt took these bastards aside, these rich sons of bitches, and said, "Look, I got you sons of bitches by the balls. I got you treason, pal. I got the goods here. We can prosecute you and put your asses in jail. So I don't want to hear any crap from you for the rest of my presidency." And they didn't. They, you know, he scared them, I think. Now, all this is my speculation, but, you know, I'm thinking, well, like, my God, especially now. No, I mean, this is very relevant. So I end the piece with that, you know, a little bit on that.
Well, listeners, that's not the whole piece either. You really need to check it out. Is Joe Biden already biting the hand that got him elected? That's the headline, and it's a great, it got my, you know, last thing I read last night before I passed out, and first thing I read this morning when I got up. You know, it's one of those articles that makes you think. Well, you know, there is some similarity to the 1876 Rutherford B. Hayes. I followed that link and was looking at it. There looks like there was eternal gridlock, and it's ironic because it's like these hardcore, hard-bitten racists that seem to influence President Donnie. And Donnie, you know, he just can't seem to get himself away from that. He's like a moth, you know, a billionaire moth that is attracted to these racist militias and shit. And there's a similarity. I don't know if you noticed this, but the South was basically gridlocking any kind of legislative action in Congress after the Civil War, Reconstruction.
And that was
a gridlock based on their innate racism, and they were pissed off over not being able to have slaves. And here it was. A little over 10 years later, and the government couldn't get anything done. Grant very reluctantly moved the federal troops, the Union soldiers, out of parts of the South, and immediately KKK-type state government took over.
Grant lost the reconstructed effort, and KKK eventually took over, essentially.
Yeah, right.
Broad brush, yeah.
And it was a horrible, horrible, horrible period, mainly because of this thing. I guess it's in our goddamn DNA in America.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
To abide by racism. You know, it just keeps coming back over and over. And people don't get that. They just can't. A lot of white privileged people, usually retired, out here that I know, they don't want to admit that they've got that about this genocide and racism in our country as a history. You know, they don't want to look at that part of our.
I don't.
Root. Yeah. You can't get them to admit that it's a foundational root of our country, of empire, of race and genocide. They just don't want to look at that. They don't. They won't even peek at it.
I agree. By this inclination of so many in the population not wanting to look at this, like, you know, the old cartoon Sergeant Schultz and Hogan's Heroes, I see nothing, you know, like,
right.
You know, that sort of as a syndrome that, of course, it just keeps going as long as you don't address it, because addressing it is painful, and people have to compromise and have to give up things and have to realize, like, wow, I've been overbearing and all that. Well, they don't want to do that, you know, they want it just the way it was before. And the way it was before was unfortunately based on a lot of unfairness. And, you know, to me, it's the most basic human nature to want to protect your family as you understand it and protect it from, you know, threats, if you will. Yeah. You may be projecting those threats, whether they're real or not. To outsiders, to aliens, to people who are different than you. And, of course, the most obvious difference is skin color. It's like, hey, God, he looks different than I do. You know, and so therefore, maybe there's a threat, you know. You know, that's why that was the basis, talk about films, that was the basis of, you know, Steven Spielberg's child adult movie called E.T., you know, the idea that, you know, and also his Strange Encounters of the Third Kind, the idea that, you know, we used to always think of space aliens, you know, the mythic fictional idea of space aliens as threatening. Somehow they're going to eat us alive, the War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells, and all this stuff. Well, he comes along and said, well, you know, maybe aliens are not threatening to us. Maybe they can look like, act like, a child's toy or something and be friendly to them. And it's, you know, it's just sort of an alien, you know, not an alien message, that's repetitive, but, addressing this fundamental human thing about we should be scared of things we don't understand.
Yeah, right.
You know, you have to be cautious of things you don't understand. Certainly, they may be dangerous to you. But anyway, I'm a little off center here.
Okay. But I never thought of Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. as that kind of. But I guess that you're right. But that would explain why on late night hate radio, conspiracy radio, I'm plagued with it. Right. That's all there is to listen to out here on the AM dial out here.
Sure.
I think that's more. I think that it's overwhelmingly white, white radio hosts, late night programs, all white, and they're more likely to accept an alien from a UFO than they would an Ecuadorian indigenous
an urban black or
from
something.
Yeah, urban black.
There you go.
Real heavy. They would. On to their running their show or being their executive producer. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I mean, I'm stunned. I got to thinking about when you mentioned it. Well, then, you know, this is the thing. I think you're on to something, and I think we're going to, I guess, see Joe as a facilitator for the status quo rather than any FDR type radical progressive.
Well, you know, the reason that I wrote this, I haven't written something for 2 months. I've had a little blockage, I guess, what to say. But, you know, this is a theme I've developed over a long time. You know, the idea of, you know, holding your nose, voting for Joe Biden, that Joe Biden could, you know, we don't want to forgive and, as I say, to be forgive and forget the things that he'd done in the past with pursuing, you know, mass incarceration crime bills and supporting George Bush's war and all that kind of stuff. Well, we don't want to, you know, we can forgive and forget, but if he, you know, if he insists on doing what he's famous for, which is, of course, crossing the aisle and getting cozy with Republicans to bring the bring a troubled Democratic Party back into power, which he did in the early 80s and with crime bills, and he's famous for that. It's like out of the gate, he's saying, well, now it's time to talk to Rep-. Well, now is not the time. I mean, it's, can't you, you know, at least accept your, you've defeated them in a major way, you know, send them out to the desert for just a while to actually stew in this and see what the hell's going on, rather than, you know, out of the gates, oh, yes, come, welcome, come, let's talk, let's you know, break bread and make policy and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's like there's time enough for that later, you know. Let them come to you instead of you going to them. And because that's what I think, that's what Obama did, especially with Obama and the health care matter. I always amazed me at the time, and many people talked about it, not just me, you know, why didn't, you know, when you start a negotiation, you start, you know, with a full hand. You're saying, hey, this is what I want, and then you whittle and negotiate down to something that is a workable compromise. Well, in his brilliance and his, you know, magnanimity or whatever it was, instead of saying, look, we're going to make Medicare for everybody, period. National socialist medicine, we're going to initiate it. It makes sense. It's what Canada has, what France, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Look, enough bullshit. Let's just do it. Well, Republicans would have been aghast and accused him of being a communist and all this, and then they could have negotiated it down. Instead, Obama basically on his own negotiates it down and gives them, you know, say, this is a negotiated possibility that you should accept. Well, if that's his opening gambit, you know, he's going to lose. And so, deal with some sense of authority here that, you know, yes, we'll deal across the aisle, but God damn it, we're going to, you know, put our position up there first, whether it's the Green New Deal or with AOC or whatever it is, you know. You've got the power now. You know, for the moment, hold on to it. Anyway, so I guess my piece was just sort of a little warning. I've been always nursing issues with Joe Biden. You know, as I say, I'm ready to forgive and forget, but it's hard to forget some of the things he's done.
Oh, God.
And then when he starts doing it, he says, yes, well, what we need now, all this difficulty is we need to talk to Republicans. Well, maybe that's a little soon, you know? Anyway, it's just sort of a warning shot, I suppose, I looked at.
Yeah, it's very thought-provoking, and I appreciate it. Listeners, I know you will, too. Go to thiscan'tbehappening.net. It's at the top, John Grant. And, I'm disappointed in it. Maybe, I don't know. Do you think this thing in Georgia is going to happen?
Oh, Georgia, I am totally on board for Georgia. I have a good friend and other friends in Atlanta who have been involved in politics there for many, many years. I really love visiting people in Atlanta. It's a wonderful city. And I think Georgia going for Biden and this upcoming double runoff on the 5th of January, I mean, I can't get enough of it. You know, I almost wish I'd moved to Georgia for it. It's like I think it is so exciting. And I was just reading about it today, the two, Loeffler and Perdue, I think, of the chicken business, Senator Perdue.
Perdue's a crook, man.
Ossoff,
man.
Ossoff, his opponent, a very clever fella, ran him down like you would not believe in a debate. The guy was like hanging his head, called him a crook to his face and everything. The guy had nothing to say about it. And then refused to ever debate the man ever again.
Well, my God, for listeners, Vincent, in case you missed it, there in our listeners in Kansas, this guy is a inside trader. This guy,
both of them are guilty of insider trading.
I mean, it's just sick. And a female, what's her name, Loeffler? I don't know.
Loeffler, yeah. Kelly Loeffler, I think.
Isn't she and she's married to the guy that runs the Security Exchange Commission? Is that correct?
Could be. I don't know. She's said to be the richest person in the Senate, I think. I read that.
Yeah, she's married to the head of the SEC, at least when she was campaigning.
SEC, I mean, I think it's fair to call her a plutocrat. She is a plutocrat, you know.
I mean, it's pathetic, and we know. I mean, here he was bailing out stocks that he knew were going to sink during the as the news of the pandemic came. He got a Perdue, okay,
right.
and immediately was profiting off of the money he made from the cataclysmic plunge of the stock market.
Right.
And the nation, as the news of the plague was
getting past.
Now, you know, this is another thing. you know that this plague is a serious son of a bitch, and these people, vulgarly paraphrase, who is the guy that died? The black guy, Herman Cain. You know, this plague is a son of a bitch. He said this coronavirus is strong.
Right. An understatement if there ever was one.
Oh, God, yeah. And it is. And these we need relief. The people out here, even these so-called white privileged people out here, I can see it. Their children who are commuting, you know, who went into lockdown, pissed off, you know, losing income, worried about their mortgage payments. And they have to, their children have to drive into the urban centers surrounding our county to make a decent living, to have that suburban lifestyle. And it's right on the edge.
Right.
I'm talking mainly retired white people, like we were talking about earlier. You know, these people see their children really on the edge. You know, it's like, I'm 38. I've got three kids and a wife, and I may lose my suburban type house here in Jefferson County.
Yeah.
Mom, I'm going to have to move back in with you. Can you handle it?
Yeah, I
can see that happening.
That's happened
a lot,
I think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and they so people need help, and here we are. Biden is stumbling over himself until Georgia comes in. I think that's what he's doing. He's stumbling over himself because he's waiting to see how Georgia goes.
Right.
Because we're going to be – in three weeks, we're going to be facing another possible government shutdown.
God, all that stuff's happening. Yeah, right. Yeah, and we're in this lame duck period. And you know, the Republicans are basically – I mean, I was just reading today about Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, Krugman column in the paper, you know, and I read about it the other day. He has put the kibosh on some federal financial ruling that is used to alleviate panics and things like that, the capacity of the federal government to declare that it will keep solvent banks and things like that by saying it will loan it money if it needs it and that kind of thing. And often, according to Krugman, examples he gave, you know, they don't even have to loan money. It's just they declare that if you need it, we will loan you money to save your bank, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Mnuchin, on his own, canceled that capacity, that ability, you know.
Yeah.
And what that means is it just creates uncertainty, and it will contribute, you know, very likely to making the finances much more difficult under Biden in the future. And I don't know, I suppose when he comes in, he can turn it back around. But, you know, I guess in this lame luck period, they're clearly, you know, trying to throw obstacles into the finances, the financial situation of the country, so that making it less likely or more difficult for a, you know, return to an economic, you know, well-run economic sort of situation here post-pandemic. So, you know, they're just putting monkey wrenches into the thing, you know, which is pretty low life, you know. I mean, are you
sick,
Americans,
dude,
or what the fuck are you? You know, it's like, I don't know.
It's,
you know,
sick. It really is sick. It's like they want to. It's like they want to burn the concert down rather than let you in on the. You know, it's like Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
I'm going to burn this down rather than let you come in and listen to our rock and roll. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
it's like you're not going to enjoy anything because you decided you didn't want me for president. Therefore,
really?
I'm not going to let you enjoy anything. You know, like,
right.
Wait a minute.
But it's not just president. It's that goddamn Mitch McConnell. That
fucking
guy.
Of course not. It's
syndrome
that runs through the party.
All these creepy people, including some that. Or from Kansas, they're lockstep. They'll do whatever Donnie says, okay? They
right.
believe in Donnie. But I can't say that. I did not. Don't you have a representative from Pennsylvania? John
mm-hmm.
Grant broadcast from Pennsylvania with me, listeners. A guy
yeah.
named Toomey?
Oh, well, he's our senator. He's our Republican senator. We have two senators, one Democrat, one Republican. Pat Toomey.
Okay.
Is a Republican, and he's making good sounds. He's said that the Biden's
he's
the winner,
breaking.
Et cetera. And he has decided
yeah.
not to run. He's not going to run again.
Oh, my God. So he's being honest for a while.
He's a lame duck on his own choice. He's a lame duck. And his position will be in play because we're definitely now a purple state. And so, you know, we could get another. I don't know if he's running in 2020. He may be up for 2022, in which case it's very likely that his position could change from Republican to Democrat. So 2022, they could, you know, Democrats could take the Senate. Even if they don't take it in Georgia, they could take it in 2022. Say they win one in Georgia, you know, in 2 years from now in midterms, Democrats could pick up, you know, at least one seat or maybe more, you know. So,
right.
And I think this is why Joe Biden is being very careful, you know, he's kissing Republican ass and all this, because, he doesn't want to be seen as a radical, certainly into, you know, before he can get the Senate on his side. So I can understand what he's
yeah.
doing. At the same time, my feeling is, look, you know, I think American politics hews to the center. It's not my idea. I think a lot of people see it. It's almost gravity. When it goes too far to the extreme, you know, the votes sort of
yeah.
take it back to the center. And, of course, Biden is a centrist, center-leftist, okay, center-left, you know, just a little off center to the left. But if he's gonna govern in the center, what does that mean? Which side, left or right, should he quote work with or, you know, compromise with and all that? Well, the government of the United States, you know, Nixon is now considered a liberal, you know. So how is this?
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, it started in the mid 70s with Richard Viguerie, direct mail, and all think tanks and yada yada. The Republicans were very, very smart. And they have an ascendancy, I've watched it since the mid 70s, to what we are right now. And it finally ended up on the pinnacle of their rise, their ascendancy. You know, as I say in the piece, they got elected somehow a criminally inclined con man as president of the United States, you know? I mean, really, I don't know, what are you going to call him other than that? And And so it's like they're at the end of their run. This ascendancy has run its course if America hews to the center. So therefore you got a Joe Biden, in order to get back to the to get the country back to the a real center, even a just center left, you don't negotiate with Republicans and the right. You need to negotiate and work with people on the left to ease it, to get the pendulum going back that way to the left, and you'll end up in the center, right? If you keep negotiating and working with the right and the Republicans, you're only going to stay where you are, you know? So logically, if all that, if we want to be centrist in this country, we're so far to the right, you need to talk to, alas, Bernie Sanders and AOC. You can't just throw them overboard, you know, once you're elected. That's certainly been done in the past, you know. You get elected, you get all these, as I say, all these leftists who would have normally disgusted with Joe Biden and voted for some, you know, Green Party lefty. This time, because of Donald Trump, they said, oh, no, no, can't do that. The Green Party isn't really where it's at. We need to hold our nose and vote for this guy Biden. And they did, I think so, for the most part. Well,
I did.
You can't blow those people off. You need to quote, and the word is work. Anyway, that's the point of my piece, you know.
Yeah, I got it. It's a great, it really brought up all that, the gridlock, the eternal gridlock, based on really white skin privilege, class, white skin, class privilege, having it being a, you know, there's an interesting, and I don't want to dwell on it, but there's an interesting professor out of University of Kansas who's got a new book. And his main subject is that there never really was a middle class.
Right.
It's a really radical book. I mean, it's really cool. I mean, it's all working class. He's like said, the middle class is like a mirage. I'm gonna have to read it, but from what parts of it that I've read, it's like it's a political football used by both parties to like lull us to sleep, you know, in a sense. Like, well, we got to preserve
it's that center I'm talking about, that real middle class center, you know, that they
Well, I don't even think that. I think he's on to something because I see a lot of middle class people on the edge, very sketchy, very sketchy. This plague has brought it out in big time, you know, and I'm going to say it. I don't care. This is could be a revolutionary opportunity for people to really make a decent society with a universal health care. And
I agree with you because that's kind of been my inclination is like the idea of protest, if you will, the idea of, you know, it doesn't mean that just because we worked hard and we got a Democrat elected president and we got rid of this criminally inclined con man doesn't mean you have to like the guy that you just elected. I mean, we're sophisticated in strategic voting. You know, people have this idea that somehow if they vote, that means that the person they voted for, you know, subscribes to every little perfection that you live with, that your ideas and all that. No, you just voted for somebody that, you know, you may not necessarily like. And so there's no reason why you can't criticize them, you know. They should be criticized. We should criticize Joe Biden if he starts talking too soon about crossing the aisle with Republicans, especially when Republicans are doing the terrible things they've been doing. You know, and I include a picture that I dredged up of, you know, Joe Biden, head of the Judiciary Committee. In the middle is Clarence Thomas in the hearing, and then in the left is Strom Thurmond, the former Dixiecrat became, you know, that Joe Biden sought out to be good buddies with, and the three of them are laughing as if there's this huge joke, And as I say in my little comic, well, you know, they just replaced the great Thurgood Marshall with Clarence Thomas. And, hey, I can see what they're laughing about. You know, wow, this is really a funny coup, baby. You know, and they just did it again, replacing this icon, my mind here, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Same Thurgood Marshall, you know, replaced her with a woman for sure. This is a woman, this is a person who is a female, okay. Congratulations, she's a female, but she's so far out of whack with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's like Clarence Thomas, and, you know, they're all laughing again, like, God, look what we just did, you know?
Yeah.
We killed a liberal, leftist, progressive icon and put this right-wing fucking whack job in and replace, and because she has a vagina between her legs and because Clarence Thomas was born black, it's okay, you know. This is identity politics going off the rails, you know.
Well, here's another way to look at it.
I'm through with my riff on that one. Okay.
No, that's okay. Here's another way to look at it. So we're going to get Joe Biden, who is a Catholic who is like reformed, okay?
Reformed Catholic.
A reformed Catholic, okay? And then you get her. Amy, and she comes from a whack, such a whacked out part that even the Catholics don't claim her as a Catholic.
Oh, well,
I mean,
like Mel Gibson's dad territory here. Yeah, right.
Yeah. we have six Catholics now on the Supreme Court.
I know. What are we? There's seven Catholics or something. How did that happen?
I don't know. God. Well, we just check it out. Brownback. I mean, Chris Kobach. I don't think Mike Pompeo is. I don't know what he is. He's just a warmonger.
He and Bolton are just flat out warmongers. Yeah.
Yeah, and no one will bid it, but Charles Koch, who prefers to be called Chucky. So I found that out.
Chucky.
No, he told a reporter, "You can call me Chucky."
What's that, like Chucky, the horror movie Chucky or what?
Yeah, good point. Chucky's got a new book out and he's selling it. And the headline in the Wichita newspaper, whenever Chucky speaks, the Wichita Eagle newspaper will print.
Oh.
Okay. Well, hell, Wall Street Journal, you can't get it. It's paywalled. But he had a major article about him in the Wall Street Journal. Chucky's got a new book out. And Chucky goes, boy, did we screw up. And he's talking about his far-right John Birch's roots supporting these crazy pro-lifers, anti-abortion people nationwide, and all Americans for Prosperity, all these
groups
that he's financed. He said, boy, did we screw up. In reference to
boy,
Donnie
did
Trump
we screw up.
That's
sounds
a
like Chuck E. Cheese there or whatever his name is.
That's a quote. I mean, so Chucky is trying to make amends and bring us. You know, John, he might pay us with some money. I've always theorized that Chucky Koch is really, really an atheist, pro-choice atheist, libertarian.
It's secret.
He wants to fill it in. I think he took LSD with his wife on the Rocky Mountains, to be absolutely honest. Like
there you go. I don't know. Yeah.
No, I really can. There's this guru, a libertarian guru in the Rocky Mountains, and Chucky and his wife, Elizabeth, they went up there, and he wrote. It's in the Sons of Wichita book about him. I've studied this guy Chucky a long time, and I think he took LSD or some hallucinogenic up there at this lodge that was. It's like a mecca in the Rocky Mountains for the libertarian people, and you know, right wing libertarians, of course.
Right.
And after he came back from his mountain trip, you might say. They got married, okay? They got legal, and then he immediately started setting up all this moves to take over the family industry.
So you're saying this all happened after an acid trip?
Yeah, I think so. I think Chucky and Elizabeth.
Well, there you go. Happened. Who knows?
Yeah. Listening to this guru, this libertarian economic guru, you know, of the Austrian School of Economics, And Chucky came back and really had and he support, you know, he didn't like Donnie Trump, and mm-hmm. but he grew to like him. You know, they have a country mm-hmm. golf course country club back literally between each other. His brother Bill, right. who lives just down the street from Mar-a-Lago. I mean, they mm-hmm. all know each other on a first name.
Well,
first
yeah, I mean,
basis.
golf brings them all together, you know.
You got it. Like, I mean, this is
you get out there in the golf carts, you drove around, you have fun driving your golf cart around.
Yeah,
of course, you don't want to
kind of
walk from hole to hole.
No, that'd be too. Helpful.
That might take too much exercise,
kind of,
you know.
This is well, Chucky, he probably would walk. I mean, he's 89. Yeah. He's pretty healthy. I mean, he's good health. But
right.
the point is that these privileged, not so middle class Kansans out here, whites, they just overlook that all that stuff, you know, about these guys are just plutocrats. They're going to support themselves as plutocrats.
Right.
Donnie's just a rundown version, a used car version of a plutocrat, and even if they're pro-choice atheists, but in public they talk like they're Methodist or you know whatever some religion, you know. But we know that they're pro-choice atheists, but they got a lot of money and we're gonna listen to them. You know?
Right.
I don't know how we really blew off our. We've got 8 minutes. God damn it.
Well, we never did get into talking about redneck movies that we had.
Well,
you know what I was speaking of, you raised the whole idea of the history leading to the Reconstruction and the KKK and all that.
Yeah.
Well, last night I witnessed I was trying to, you know, I was looking up, I must have found like 20, you know, movies on Netflix that would qualify as redneck cinema, but I watched this movie from 1974, the kind of the blaxploitation period, but this one is called The Klansman, starring Lee Marvin.
Wow.
And Lee Marvin is the sheriff, and he's very very laconic and taciturn. He doesn't say much, but he's Lee Marvin, he's a fucking badass, you know. He's sheriff.
Right.
And the KKK is a very active participant in the movie because it's called The Klansman, and of course from a novel, and the Lee Marvin character says I'm in every organization from, you know, the Lions Club to everything because I'm a sheriff, and yeah, I am a member of the Klan. But he's a good guy, you know. And since he's killed at the end by the Klan, it's okay, you know.
God.
But the Klan, there's two. Oh, this is a tawdry, pretty poor movie, I would give it. I would maybe give it two stars, to be generous. A lot of bad movies, it really does play out all of those factors like the Klan. I mean, the Klan are created. There's cops who are in the Klan, and there's two rapes. There's a black guy rapes a woman, and then of course one of the cops has to rape the black activist woman who comes down from the north. And it's a tawdry, sort of movie. It's not a great movie. It's not in the heat of the night, you know, but it's that same milieu. It's a movie we could forget about, but, you know, there's a lot to talk about it if you want to talk about the KKK, because the KKK and, you know, sexual politics, racial politics are, you know, really, really played up in this movie as provocative. And this is 1974, it's very interesting to look at.
I think I saw that son of a bitch in
you probably did.
In Coffee County, we had to drive 22 miles to the nearest drive-in.
Right.
And I think I saw that damn thing at the drive-in. I'm not kidding you.
Here, 1974, and the guy who is the local black gorilla who's assassinating some of the people, of the guys who had, you know, caught his buddy and actually grotesquely castrated him. This is a very tawdry movie. He's now so pissed off that he's knocking them off, the five guys that did this, white guys. Throughout the movie, he sprinkles it. He comes with a rifle and bing, knocks. He's knocked about four of them off. Well, you guess who is playing this black radical assassin?
Man, this is
O.J. Simpson.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
It's O.J. As a young O.J., is maybe his first role. He's playing a radical black. Talking about this. He's a radical black dude. And he's
an assassin.
And he's sort of winking at Lee Marvin. Lee Marvin is really a good guy in this movie. And he understands black anger. And so he sort of wink-wink at the guy who's knocking off the police or the guys and the KKK guys who had just castrated his buddy. He'd watched it, you know, and so he's naturally pissed off. This is like plot C-15, you know, some incident happens and throughout the film this is the Spielberg movie Munich, the same plot, done much, much better about the Olympic murders, how they go and knock off all those Palestinians in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, it's a plot device. C-15, plug it in, you know. And
I don't know about that. It just sounds pretty juicy to me. I call it juicy. I mean,
it is. That's a good word for it. This is race and sex put together in violence.
Yeah.
Race, sex, and violence. And you heat it up and you stir it, and this is it. Juicy as they come.
I'm going to watch it. You say it's on Netflix.
The Klansman. Irony is, of course, the protagonist is the sheriff, and, you know, he is in the Klan, but as he said, he tells some, you know, guy that, I have to be in the Klan. I'm a sheriff. You know, I have to be in all the organizations. Yeah, it's like the Lions Club. You know, I do this.
Yeah.
You know, I join all these groups because I'm the sheriff to keep it all together here, you know.
I have to
be part of the Klan since the Klan is who we are, you know.
Who we are.
But at the same time, he's a liberal, he's a good guy, and he can sort of wink at O.J. over there after he's just assassinated one. Okay, brother, I understand your pain, you know.
Go ahead, kill him.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting movie to talk about, as poor and stupid as the movie is. I'm sorry, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I think, like I said, I think I saw that, honestly.
You probably did. That doesn't make it a good movie, though, you know.
Well, yes, it does. It'll take me back to that an equally juicy moment when I was in the front seat with Anita. Right out of high school as a drive-in.
Drive-ins,
you know,
Anita. Well, that's another topic.
trying to get playing Stinky Finger with while I'm watching that movie. I swear, I think I watched that movie in 1975.
With Anita? With Anita?
Yeah, at the drive-in.
Now here you go. You're talking about it with Anita and the drive. Wonder where Anita is right now. What if Anita were listening to this?
she'll just say what she told me 5 years ago when I returned to the house. You know what she said?
What?
She said, "You had your chance. You blew it."
You had your chance back at the drive-in watching the Klan.
Right. Right.
You blew your chance, pal. Yeah.
I should.
What a world. Okay.
So thanks for the memory, brother. I mean, I'm going to watch The Klansman on Netflix tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's available on Netflix. That's where I got it. I got the DVD.
We can't reserve the last 8 minutes of the show next week. We've got to dwell on these goddamn movies. Okay, buddy?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to watch.